Welcome to Recess Duty, a podcast for educators to come together to share struggles, but also celebrate successes by sharing stories and ideas in a safe and supportive environment to collaborate with one another. Here's your host, Levi Allison.
Hey everyone, this is Recess Duty with your host, Levi Allison, and today we're talking with learning pioneer, Louise Hurd. Thank you so much for joining us, Louise. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. I've just rushed down from my class, having just spent the day with 3 and 4-year-olds, so hoping I make some sort of sense to an adult audience.
I totally understand, and as our audience works with kids, I can imagine they are going to be very compassionate listeners and understanding the day-to-day of a teacher running back and forth from a classroom, going into a meeting, and then going back to a classroom. So Thank you so much, Louise, for taking time to talk with us about early years. I'm so excited to get to pick your brain a little bit about inquiry, play, agency, and learning as it is with our youngest learners in the PYP. So Louise, first, those of us who don't know you or haven't followed you on Twitter, which I highly recommend, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into education?
So I think I was always going to be a teacher.
Nice.
I think I really started teaching at 3 years old when I attended nursery school. My mum was the nursery nurse and my grandmother, her mother-in-law, was the nursery teacher. So oh, wow. I was the only child who stayed full days because in London, in England, you have half days as a 3-year-old. So in the afternoons, my afternoons were spent with, well, Louise, you can help your friends learn and you can help them to support them with what they're doing in the classroom. So I think my career, I feel like, started there.
Way to start, though.
Yeah, I mean, definitely an interesting time. You know, remembering to call them Mrs. Hurd and Mrs. Hurd. I mean, always a challenge. but yeah, that was lots of fun. And I think I really hold those experiences still now. They're quite a big part of my own teaching philosophy. I remember when I first taught, when I first was in reception, when I was 4 and 5, I remember there were 2 classes and I was obviously in the other class to the one that my grandmother was teaching in. And I was bored. My classroom was one that had quite a formal education at 4 years old. I was a summer born child and remember it being very much about sitting at tables and listening to the teacher. And I remember doing that classic, I'll go to the bathroom to have a bit of a break and escape. Tried to swing around the toilet cubicle like some sort of gymnastic routine, hit my head. Instead of sending me home and losing a member of staff, I was sent into my grandmother's class where I remember walking in and seeing there was seaweed hanging from the washing lines in her class. There was the sound of the sea where she'd recorded it on a little cassette tape player. Children had their feet in like a water tray and a sand tray. So they were immersed as if they were at the beach. There were kids painting and building. And I remember even at that young age thinking, you know, why have I got this raw deal? Why can't I be learning in this environment and this space? Why do I need to be sat at a table listening to the teacher and writing all day? And that for me is probably why I'm such a play advocate, where I think from a young age really saw that benefit and felt that as a child, that firsthand experience.
And I think that is something we all connect with, was going into early years rooms from when we were growing up as adults versus what we see almost mainstream now, where it is a lot more hands-on. It is a lot more play-driven, inquiry-driven, question-oriented, where kids are making up their own discoveries. Whereas when I grew up, it was very much sit at a table, rote memorization, handwriting for hour a day, worksheets upon worksheets upon worksheets. And as somebody that's now helping other people emerge into this play and inquire and agency in early years, what does that look like in the early years for those of us who may not be so well-versed in that?
Yeah, well, they're actually, this week has just been a brilliant speech in the Scottish Parliament where they've just decided to make a kindergarten grade for their students. So they're starting more formal education later. And that's a brilliant sort of speech in terms of the case for play and why it's so important. I think for any of us, doesn't matter how old you are, if you're 3 or I'm 33, play is still important to every one of us. and my friend Michael Pelagi, who you had on the podcast previously. We talk a lot about play. We're both real advocates, and we talk about how important it is as grown-ups to have our own play identities. And, you know, for me, that would be rock climbing. And that's, for me, you know, problem solving and creating solutions to puzzle pieces. For other people, it might be they get a new slow cooker and they're testing out different recipes and they're playing with ideas. Or maybe you get a new camera and you're, you know, pressing all the buttons, probably not all the ones you're meant to, maybe not following the instructions in the guide, but all of that is play. And I think sometimes we see play as this thing that is just for children, and actually it's important to all of us, and it's how all of us use that trial and error. I think it's the real basis of so many scientific and music explorations, where we have this idea, we're testing a solution, but we're playing with different ideas. So for me, I think that's got a real place in the classroom, where I see that every day. You walk into my classroom and you see children immersed in all different areas, whether they are building and they're also practicing those mathematical skills as they're working out the properties of different shapes. They might be playing with the bugs in the small world area and they're noticing different characteristics and different features of those, or creating stories about them, which then leads into their writing later on. They're sharing the knowledge that they have from home already at that young age of, you know, I'm somebody who can hold and, you know, share this knowledge with others. And they're communicating, they're problem solving, they're collaborating with others. And I think particularly as, I'm currently in a PYP candidate school, so looking at all of these characteristics that we're hoping the children learn, those attributes to learning, and that's in a play-based environment so organically, particularly also that agency. But for me, I think one of the fundamental things that the beginning of this year I'm really focusing on is making sure I know those children and I'm getting to know them. If I want that agency to be happening, if I want those inquiries to begin, I need to know where the children are. You can't teach them unless you know them. So really making sure that we have those relationships, and that helps me have a greater insight into their play and their play identities.
Isn't all of our great and best practice rooted in the fundamentals of relationships and making sure that we know the kiddos? What are their interests? What are their hobbies? What are their questions? Honoring those hobbies and questions and curiosities. And when you're talking about play, it is such a beautiful connection of inquiry. Inquiry is fundamentally play. Inquiry is having a question, a curiosity, a wondering, and going out and trialing and erroring it. Like you said, it was try it. If it makes an error, what could you do differently? And going back and forth, researching different ways. And what a beautiful connection. What do you say to an early years practitioner who is struggling with that balance between play, inquiring, and the older model of teaching of rote memorization, looking, going back and forth? What do you say to those people?
As Kath Murdoch says, play is the purest form of inquiry. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely I see in my class. Now I'm, as you know, as the children are getting older and I'm getting to know them in my class, I'm showing them how their play can become an inquiry. Play has no particular end. There is no, I need to find this answer out. I need to answer this question that I have in my head. There is just, you know, it's in joy, and that's in being in the moment. Whereas inquiry really is taking it those steps further. Mm-hmm. And particularly young children, that inquiry cycle, I know that Kath talks about how it's not always, you know, those each section flows one to another. Yes. Sometimes it's messy and we go back and forth. And that's exactly what we see in children's play. Children aren't afraid of that. I think when we talk about the more traditional sense of teaching, I think it's important to share that it doesn't mean that as an advocate for play, I don't believe in direct instruction. It doesn't mean I don't teach the children things. It's just that there are key moments that I choose to use that direct instruction. So, for example, you know, if I, at the children in my class, there was a conversation they had about a bug they found. One child thought it was a cricket. One thought it was a grasshopper. Slowly more friends shared which one they were voting for. And in that moment, I could have left that. But actually, let's show the children how we can record this. So I will teach them how to do that chat tally chart to show this many people think it's a cricket, this many think it's a grasshopper. And, you know, how to then take that on and, you know, how can we find out the real answer? How do we take that even further? Where can we find more information out from books or research or asking others? And I think for me, it's important to use that direct instruction in those key moments. There's that great phrase that is direct instruction happens not just in case, but just in time. And as an adult, absolutely.
That's really cool.
Stepping back, it's observing and noticing. I describe it a bit like when you're playing jump rope and you see somebody skipping. You need to get your timing right to jump in, or you're going to get yourself tangled up, or it's not going to quite work. And that's what it is as an educator. So much of the time, as an experienced play advocate, I will jump in at the wrong time. And that is normal. And that's an important thing to share, that sometimes I jump in and nope, they're not interested in recording that, or they're not interested in finding it out anymore. And they slowly teeter away. And that's okay. There's more opportunities and more moments. And having that patience with that and not feeling like I need to force it, just giving those opportunities. So there is the potential to take that further, but it's not an expectation from the adult on the child.
Agreed. And I keep thinking about what you said before about being a advocate of play, but also knowing when direct instruction is needed to propel the learning and inquiry further. And I think with the more conversations I have with educators on the podcast and on Twitter and in conferences and presentations, that there is a big misunderstanding of what play-based learning is and what it is not. I know from personal experience, I believed when I was starting out that play was just a free-for-all, that everything was going on, and that was not working well with me. You know, using music as an example, we have very expensive instruments. And if it was just play in a free for all, it was going to turn into a circus. It really was. And things were going to get broken. And I knew that this wasn't going to work for me. So I had to figure out, what does that mean? What does play-based learning mean in terms of scaffolding skills that are needed to prolong and propel those kids' learning journeys? What do you say to those misconceptions to people?
I think there's a great amount of research done at the moment by the Lego Foundation who are researching into play. I would encourage people to look at their website for more information on that. And they've got a great kind of spectrum of play where it talks about there being this one end where it's the free play, where that's just, you know, no interruptions, no expectations. And the other end of the spectrum is that direct instruction. But there's a big space in between. Mm-hmm. And I think so often that's, you know, that's where maybe that more structured inquiry might happen. And we might also see more playful games like maths games emerging. And that's, you know, where there's that balance between the two. And there is a place for all of that within the classroom. I think it just is reading and learning and speaking to people who, as educators, you see play working for them in their environment. I'm really lucky that I've had some amazing colleagues who have been new to early years, which is always exciting because I get to see them. You know, those moments where you see a child read for the first time and it suddenly makes sense to them. I get to see that with colleagues who play suddenly makes sense to them, and they realize, oh, this is how I follow children's interests. And I think there's a lot of talk about the importance of play, but maybe not so much evidencing and sharing in what does that following children's interests actually look like in practice. That's probably one of the biggest things that people ask me. And my friend Michael and I, we talk quite often in any presentations we do. We're both practicing teachers, and we try and make sure we're really sharing those examples of, this is what my class looked like today, and here are some examples of how I slowly built on that.
And knowing Michael as well, and hearing about his experience of, you know, using kids' interests and identity and how that shaped his inquiry in classroom throughout that unit was really inspiring to see that those interests of students can happen even at our earliest years. And the learning is still as authentic and robust as even our PYP exhibition, for example. So when you're looking at students' interests in theories and so forth, how are you taking those ideas and grafting them into your units of inquiry or your math journeys or your reading writing workshops?
So at the moment, so we're a PYP candidate school, and our first unit is Who We Are, which mm-hmm. will be a year long unit. And we've really made that about identity, and those lines of inquiry are about us finding out our own characteristics, not just our physical characteristics, but who we are or who we are becoming as people. Are we caring? Are we a risk taker? But also how we use those to also connect with others. This is our first year of being a multi-age classroom. So I have the 3 and 4 year old age group and the 4 and 5 year old age group all together in one class. And for us, that's a great opportunity for our older learners to see they're able to help our younger learners, but also to see that could be the other way around as well, because we've all met a 3-year-old who knows how to name every dinosaur under the sun.
Yes, yeah.
Much better Latin pronunciations of those dinosaurs than I could ever have.
For sure.
And, you know, I think so often we see our youngest children as coming, being ready to be filled with information, and actually they come with so much already. So for us, it's how do we connect with home? How do we connect with our students to really find out those interests? So we've had our parents sharing what they think is really important to their child. But we also began our year with listening conferences, where it's not about me sharing what happens at school. It's about me meeting with the parents and the child to say, what are you interested in? What would you like to do when you come to school? And I then straight away from the beginning of the year, am saying to those children, I value what you say. Your voice is important in my classroom. And this is a space where you have ownership, because in that first meeting, you're telling me you're interested in insects. It's not something I would necessarily have thought to put out in my provision in the beginning of the year, but I've got a real insect enthusiast. So that is what was in my provision. So from day one, he arrived and saw that already I'm listening to him and I'm actioning that within the environment. And I just think it's so important to think each day. So Mark Finnis, who's the author of Restorative Practice, mm-hmm. he's got a great phrase, which is, relationships aren't built in a day, they're built daily. And it's really about us thinking each day, how am I listening to those students and how am I showing them that I'm listening? How am I responding to what they're saying? Rather than it just being in that moment, that conversation, it might be a 2-second conversation with a 3-year-old, but actually sharing that they're interested in insects means that we have this whole inquiry about them, which has now emerged all based on that listening conference. I think that's really important to focus on how we connect with them and honor their voice from the start.
And again, what a beautiful example of listening to their voice and how it impacts the choices made into the classroom, that they are, even at our youngest age, the sole driver of the learning in the classroom. So how do you recommend for teachers trying to honor those voices and choices of our youngest learners? How can they do a more authentic job in the future for that?
I think it's making sure that we have the space to really hear their voices. If we are filling the day with our own agenda and making sure we're sharing those math or literacy objectives, there isn't necessarily that space for children to share what they're interested in.
True.
It's us making sure that, for me, I'm really focusing on making sure my provision is that third teacher so that the children are immersed in that. And that gives me the time and the space to step back and really observe and monitor what is happening, to be able to step in at the right time, time my jump into that jump rope cycle and know that, okay, I'm noticing you're interested in trains and let's explore that a bit more. And how can we? So I had children who, as we often do, were interested in trains. Some of them had been on trains in London, some in Japan. We researched and saw the differences. We learned about bullet trains. That's now emerged into learning about monorails. That's so we've cool. had a whole train system with a ground train system and then a monorail system on top. And then adding in, okay, if we want cars, how can we now make roadways amongst this? And how can we balance our ramps and make sure everything is supported? How can we add in a train station? And then we've got tickets and then we've got maps and, you know, all of that mark making is happening, all of that maths and recording numbers and having those conversations. That will all come if we honor those inquiries and follow those children's interests. It's us having faith in ourselves as educators that I know what the children need to learn. I know those key skills I need to be teaching them. And I know that I can thread those in through any of their inquiries, be it at the painting table, you know, submerged in paint, be it in, you know, creating monorail systems or creating a little taco shop based on the children's interest in the role play area. I can thread all of that learning in anywhere. There is no one way and no right way to do that.
I love that you use the analogy of threading, because I have a wonderful mentor, Dr. Deborah Hedden, who used to work at the University of Kansas. And she wrote this beautiful book about threading learning through multiple modes of learning, whether it was physical, audio, sight, and all those type of things. And I just, and it really impacted the way that I look at learning now as a way of making sure that kids reach any learning avenue through a way that works for them and a way that makes sense to them and a way that makes them want to come back to it. And I love that you brought that into play and in learning and inquiry is a way for students to thread their learning to make sense for them own. Because isn't that what we're all trying to do, is make sure that these kids love learning? And what better way for them to love it than using their interests at heart?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so important to still hold on to that, not just in early years, that play-based learning and that inquiry-based learning. But my friend who is a grade one teacher, Bree Collishaw, who's also in Luxembourg with me, she, with her grade one students last year, she was really listening to them and they were interested in living things, having lots of discussions about that. Instead of trying to push through, you know, this is the agenda and pacing for our, you know, writer's workshop, for example, she stepped back and noticed, actually, this persuasive writing fits in really nicely here because they want a class pet. And they've written letters to the head teacher and the principal to say, this is how we promise we're going to be responsible. We've researched. We are really knowledgeable. And here are our agreements that we would have within the class. And they now have got a pet hamster. So I think it's, you know, honoring those voices. That can happen whether you are three, it can happen in grade three, it can happen up into secondary. And I think it's really important to make sure we're giving children space in our timetable and our schedules to demonstrate what is important to them, rather than us just asking them on some sort of worksheet style, tell me what's important to you document at the beginning of the year. It's constant, because our identities are constantly evolving and changing. What I would fill out in a form at the beginning of the year will hopefully be different towards the end of the year as I connect with others and I follow more interests and I'm exposed to different kinds of learning. I think that's important to have that ever-evolving perspective on it.
Louise, what are some connections, if you had to pick a few connections for future teachers, teachers just starting out in inquiry and play, that you want to really highlight between play and inquiry?
For me, I'm sure many of us know that visual from Trevor McKenzie, his sketch note of the swimming pool and the different styles of inquiry. Mm-hmm. And I kind of would add in, like in a swimming pool, sometimes you have that little paddling pool area where you're trying things out.
Yeah,
I think that for me, we've got play and that is an inquiry in itself. It just might not have as much structure. And I think that's where that free play starts to emerge. What I do as an early years teacher is I may not necessarily, it might not be me saying this is what our inquiry is. I listen to the children and I show them how they can start to find out more. For example, today we discussed what are they interested in terms of what do they like to play. They've recorded that, shared at a home on Seesaw, and then we started making connections to say, do you know what, I also like trains, or I also like reading stories about princesses. We're now going to have some book clubs where we'll meet in a small group of children who are interested in that topic. And we're saying, okay, how do we now take this interest? How do we explore it further? How do we extend that? Do we have some questions after reading this book about trains that we'd like to find out? Do we want to read more books and see if there's different kinds of things? Do we want to connect with some others who have those shared interests in other grades or classes? Do we want to use that in the classroom in some way? How can we make our classroom train area look more like the stations and the tracks that we see in these books? I think it's important for us to demonstrate that, which we do all the time. Teachers are naturally inquirers and It's just us making that explicit and naming and noticing those behaviors that we have. We're aware that we're doing those things and we're stepping them and pushing them the next step further, but making sure that's really explicit and that we share that with the children.
Thank you so much for sharing those connections and how we can help our kids and students make those connections and develop their learning attitude toward learning as well. Luis, where can people find you if they want to continue learning with you and continue their own development of play-based learning?
The best way to be able to contact and connect with me would be on Twitter. So I am at LouNerd, LOUNERD, number 3. Because I am very much an educational nerd.
I totally connect with that with my whole being, as I know what it means to be a nerd on Twitter. My very dear friend Tanya and I talk about what Twitter has done for us in a global mindset and as a community and as collaboration. So yes, we should absolutely connect with you on Twitter. Luis, what else do you remember about recess growing up?
I actually discussed this question the other night with my friend Erica, who is a big fan of the podcast, and told me this was, made sure I remembered this would be coming. I think for me, I really remember it being a time I looked forward to. I'm very much a social creature, and I loved connecting with not only my friends from my class, but that was a time to connect with my younger brother's friends and, you know, connections I had through outside activities in older grades. So for me, recess was about connecting. It was also about, you know, that real feminist in me demonstrating that I was better than all of the boys at football and that girls can play football. But a real vivid memory I have in primary school was being told when I was in a class that was maybe not the most inquiry or play based. I was a frequent visitor to the medical room for the odd, you know, glass of water and escapism, and being told, no, Louise, we know you're not sick, go back out to play. And being in the playground, being sick in one of the plant pots. I must have been about 7 years old and remember being really proud of myself. Not only had I proved them wrong, but also I made a pun where I, as I was being taken away, I asked if there would be a sycamore tree growing there. You know, I think that that's, I've evolved and grown into my puns more throughout the years. So for recess duty, I really remember those kind of connection moments.
What a wonderful story. And I cannot wait for people to hear this, as I think that is going to be just a highlight of people's day to hear that story. Thank you, Luis, for coming to this week's episode of Recess Duty. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast app so that you don't miss our next episode. I'm Levi Allison, and I hope you have a great day of learning, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Recess Duty. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. In the meantime, please share this podcast with other educators so they can join the fun. And that is the end of our Recess Duty.